Okay, so your tests are graded. I posted your scores also on Canvas, and I've also posted solutions at the top of our Canvas page. But you all did very well. I think the average score was about 90%. And so, yeah, well over half the class is at this point probably looking at an A in the course, but things are going to get more difficult. Not so much more difficult, but you have to stay at it. We're going to make a transition now into more theoretical material where the calculations that you did on the first exam are going to come into play over and over again. However, what I'm going to do as I lecture now is I'm not going to step through the details of a row reduction calculation. Maybe give you a matrix that you started off with and its row echelon form, so I don't have to do those tedious calculations on screen so much. But let me pass these back. Yacoub, are you here? All right. Sylvan? Anthony Brombach? Yeah. Roger Bennett? David Calvert? Jason Costello? Peyton Dreyer, Lisa Fisher, Derek Holloway, Eric Inman, Thomas Kidd. I'll have him pick it up. Paxton Kraft. Okay. Thomas Kidd, are you here? No, not yet. Okay. Paxton Kraft. Eli Lucas. Spencer. Madge. Spencer here. Okay. Tyler Martinez. Andrew Mason, Colin Myers, Jacob O'Hara, Jaden Patel, Myla Reed, last name Reed, yeah. Stephen Riccole, Vivian Taylor, Jordan Wheeler, Munson? Let's see. Alexander Wilburn. Madison Wilson. All right, some people wandered in. Anyone not have an exam? Yeah, what's your name? Okay, so most of the errors on the exam were contrivial. There were some problems with row reduction. Did you not get an exam? Oh, yeah. Names?
Yeah.
Okay, so I can answer questions on the exam, but I suggest you look at the solutions that are posted. If you want to argue for more points and the like, please have a look at the solutions first, and maybe then you'll spot your error. But given that the class average was 90, I'm not so inclined to step through the exam in class. And if you have any difficulties at all understanding the posted solutions, you can come talk to me, visit me during my office hours, etc. Okay? But once again, for those who came in late, the average was 90%, which means that the vast majority are doing well in this course, and you can probably continue to do so, because I'm not going to change things up. The second exam, we will review the same way. We'll give you a practice exam, and as long as you sort of follow my directions, you should do well in this course. All right, so what I want to do today is move forward in the material a little bit. Just prior to the exam, I talked a little bit about subspaces. I'm going to review that real quickly, and then today's lecture, we're going to get into the meat of how to deal with subspaces. Well, typically your basic problem is you might have a three-dimensional subspace embedded in a 10-dimensional space. You don't want to use 10 different coordinates to specify the vectors that live in a three-dimensional space. And so we're going to address that problem as a coordination problem for subspaces, and we'll resolve that fairly quickly. But you'll notice that the way I resolve it is simply by changing my definitions to give me something that will allow me to coordinatize subspaces. And that's going to be related to linear independence. By choosing special vectors that are linear independent, then the coordination of subspaces is easy. And then at the end, if I get that far, we'll look at the row space of a matrix. And this will be a subspace that we can attach to any matrix, and we'll describe how we actually coordinatize those vectors. And in fact, this example here, the row space of a matrix, is actually the prototype for a general calculation. Even when we're dealing with subspaces that are different than the row space of the matrix, we'll tend to take coordination problem is we'll rephrase it as a problem of finding a row space of a matrix. So it looks like a particular example, but in fact this example is crucial to calculations. Okay, so let me remind you what a subspace is. Well, basically the idea is to find a little vector space inside a larger vector space, but the key point in linear algebra is also always those two fundamental operations of scalar multiplication and vector addition. So what we require of a subspace, a subset, to really be regarded as a vector space sitting inside a larger vector space, is we want to be able to maintain the two fundamental vector operations inside our little vector space. So what we require is that we not only have a subset, so every vector is going to be a vector in a larger vector space, but what we require is that if we take a vector that lives inside that subspace and we multiply it by any real number, we don't leave that subspace. And similarly, if we start off with two vectors that start off living in the subspace, we add them together, we don't want to leave that set. We want the set to be closed under scalar multiplication and vector addition, so those two operations can be performed freely without leaving the set. All right, so that's the idea. And of course, the counterexample you might keep in mind is a simple set. If you have points on a circle, so all these vectors here, they're not going to be a subspace because, for example, if I multiply a vector by 2, I get a vector twice as long and it takes me off the circle. If I add two vectors together, I get a point that in general is going to lie off the circle. So most of the sets that you know from plane geometry are not going to be subspaces. What they have to do is, first of all, since I can multiply by any number, these vectors are sort of can be as long or short as I want, and they still have to stay inside the set. So any finite region in the plane is not going to be a subspace, because by multiplying by a large enough number, you could take it outside that set. Okay, but the point is that these are the very special kinds of sets that are really dominant in linear algebra. All right, so there's two ways of making a subspace that are pretty standard. The first way, what I want for a subspace is for it to be closed with respect to scalar multiplication and vector addition. What if I take all possible scalar multiplications and all possible vector additions? Well, then these two conditions are automatically, because the definition in this set says that if I add two vectors, like so, it's going to be inside the set. If I scalar multiply a vector, it's still going to be inside that set. So this definition, you can think of it as a simple way of imposing these two conditions on a set. You demand that every vector in the subset S is created by taking linear combinations and scalar multiples of a given list of vectors. Geometrically, these guys are going to be hyperplanes, except they're special hyperplanes. They're hyperplanes that actually pass through the origin. We call that a more general hyperplane. These are sets of the form you have a starting point, and then you stray from that starting point along a given list of directions, say KVK, and then you let the parameters T1 through TK range over the entire real line. So this is a typical hyperplane. This formula here, what's missing? It's missing this offset P0. Or you can think of it, if I take this as defined to be zero, then I don't need to add to it. And then you've got that span displayed as a hyperplane. So these spans are special cases, and they correspond to flat, higher dimensional surfaces that pass through the origin. A second way of producing a subspace is by solving a linear system. But just like for a general linear system, such as A times X is equal to B. So this is some coefficient matrix times a vector of variables equal to some vector constants here. This general linear system, its solution set is always going to be a hyperplane. But the special cases we're looking at today are going to be the span, so subspaces, so it's going to be where P0 is equal to zero, and also solution sets of equations. But now the right hand side here is not an arbitrary vector, it has to be the zero vector. So the solution sets of linear equations of this form are going to be hyperplanes of this form. They're going to be exactly the span. And in fact, the special case is what we're looking at today. We have subspaces. Okay, so the problem we're going to address today is, given a set of vectors or a subset that's generated by a given list of vectors, generated by taking linear combinations of the given list of vectors, how do we coordinatize this set? I might have 5 vectors here, but each vector itself might be a 10-dimensional vector. So how do I coordinatize that 5-dimensional space when it lives inside a 10-dimensional space. Well, here's the idea. Every element in the span has to be a linear combination of the generators. And so every vector inside W, it has to be capable of being written in this fashion. Otherwise, it wouldn't live in the span. It would not be a linear combination of those vectors. So the idea would be to use these K coefficients, put them in an ordered list, and regard that as a coordinate vector for the elements in of W. However, unless we put some additional conditions on these vectors W1 through WK, there might be more than one way of writing a vector, and so we might have a single point with two different coordinates. And that what you need for good coordinates is a one-to-one pairing between the object you're trying to study and your numerical vectors that are describing points in them. And so let me give you an example of the issue here. So here's a set of three vectors, and I'm going to take the set of all possible linear combinations of these three vectors. So that means I'm considering vectors of the form of some constant times the first vector, some constant times the second vector, some constant times the third vector. Any vector of this form is going to belong to S, so I can think of coordinatizing the points of S by the numbers C1, C2, and C3. Given those numbers, I can construct a vector that's going to live inside that set. Well, that's all and good, except here I'm going to show you two different choices of numbers that produce the same vector. So here's one choice. I choose the first coefficient of 1, second coefficient 1, the third coefficient 0. Sum the linear combination up, I get the vector 2, 0. But for this same three generators, I can choose a different list of coefficients, 0, 0, and 2. And in this case, I construct the linear combination, add them up, I get the same vector. So is this point 2, 0, which lives inside this subspace, does it have coordinates 1, 1, 0, or does it have coordinates 0, 0, 2? It's ambiguous. And so this is the situation we're trying to avoid. We want to have unique coordinates for every point in a subspace, not a choice. All right, so the way we'll resolve this is effectively we'll define our way out of the problem. Here's the relevant definitions. A basis for a subspace is a set of vectors such that every vector can be written as a linear combination of these vectors. So this means in particular that S has to be the span of these vectors. But in addition, not only can we express them as a linear combination, but in fact, with that adjective there, we want a unique way of expressing every vector in terms of the vectors B1 through BK. So if the set of vectors B1 through BK is a basis, then not only can we reach every vector in the set by taking linear combination, but in fact, there's only one way to reach a given vector via such a linear combination. And then what we can do is now the choices of the numbers C1, C2, through CK, they're going to be unique. That's hidden in the definition. So if we have a basis and we see an expression for a vector inside a subspace written in terms of that basis, then we know the numbers C1 through CK are unique by definition, not by something we have to prove. However, how do we actually check this? That's harder. Given a subspace that was generated by a list of vectors, how do we tell if it's actually a basis? Do we have to check every vector inside the subspace to make sure that there's only one way to write it? Well, that would be what we would need to do if we wanted to use the definition directly. But what I'll show you next is there's a simpler test to see whether or not a given set of vectors is a basis. So this has to do with a new notion called linear independence. So Forget about subspaces for a second now. Suppose I have a list of vectors. And suppose they're related by an equation of this form. Scalar multiples of this set of vectors, certain scalar multiples, you add them up and you get the zero vector. Suppose that the only solution of this equation, thinking of the coefficients x1 through xk as variables, suppose the only solution of that is by taking all the coefficients separately equal to zero. Then we'll say that the vectors w1 to wk are linearly independent. So that's a special condition. And what I want to show you is that if you have a set of generators that are linearly independent, then they're automatically going to be a basis. Now, that's an improvement over the definition, because to apply the definition directly, I have to show that every vector inside my subset has a unique representation as a linear combination of my given list of vectors. But with this notion of linear independence, the theorem I'm about to show you says I only have to check that the zero vector can be uniquely represented as a linear combination. Then I'll know that, in fact, my generators are actually a basis for the subspace they generate. Okay, so let me prove this theorem. Let me move it up, statement up, so we can not in the middle of the screen. Suppose we have a subspace that's generated by a given list of vectors. The question is can every vector in W be represented by a unique linear combination of these guys? If that's the case, then the vectors are going to be a basis. So the statement of the theorem is that W1 through WK is going to be a basis for the subspace it generated from them if and only if the given list of vectors are linearly independent, meaning that there's only one solution, only one linear combination of these vectors that equals the zero vectors. All right, so let me show you how that works. Suppose I'll label by B the set of vectors. And we'll suppose this is an if and only if statement. That means both the forward statement and the converse statement are true. So I'll do the forward statement first. I'll assume that I have a basis, and I'll show you that necessarily the vectors are linearly independent. All right, so if since B is a basis, well, in particular, that means every vector inside W has a unique expression as a linear combination of those vectors. The zero vector also has to live inside W, because scalar multiplication by zero is always going to produce the zero, and subspaces are always closed under scalar multiplication. So the zero vector is going to be an example of a vector that lives inside capital W. What I want to show is that if these guys are a basis, then in fact the only solution of this equation is obtained by setting C1 through CK separately equal to zero. Well, because B is a basis, any vector in W has a unique expansion. In particular, the zero vector has a unique expansion. Okay, so there's only going to be one choice of the numbers C1 through CK that satisfy this condition, given the hypothesis that these vectors are a basis for the subspace they generate. However, it's also pretty clear that C1 is equal to zero, C2 is equal to zero, all coefficients equal to zero. If you make these substitutions on the right-hand side, you're going to get zero. So in fact, this is a solution of this equation. The hypothesis is that there's only one solution. And so if this equation is true, then you can conclude then that all the coefficients have to separately vanish. If an equation like that holds and all the coefficients have to vanish, that means they're linearly independent, and we're done. Okay, so the object in this forward direction is to assume we have a basis, and then use that to conclude that the basis vectors satisfy an equation like this with only one solution, a trivial solution. And then to go the opposite way, suppose that I have a set of vectors that are linearly independent. So the only way I can add them up and produce a zero vector is by taking all the coefficients equal to zero. Well, and let's suppose also that we look at the space that's generated by these vectors. The claim is that if these vectors are linearly independent, then these vectors are also going to generate W. Well, that's given by the way I've constructed W, but there's going to be a unique way of writing any vector inside W as a linear combination of these guys. So here's what we'll do. We're going to assume that our vectors are linearly independent and that they generate the given subspace capital W. What I want to show is there's only one way of writing any vector inside W as a linear combination of the given list of vectors. So I'll do a proof by contradiction. Suppose I had two different ways of writing a particular vector inside W. Well, what I can do then is I can take these two equations, I can subtract the second equation from the first. Well, B minus D is going to be the zero vector, and then C1 W1 minus D1 W1 is going to be this term. You can see how that's going to work out. But now, my hypothesis is that the vectors W1 through WK are linearly independent. Well, that means that the only way you can solve this equation is by setting all the coefficients equal to zero. So if these guys are linearly independent, each of these coefficients has to equal zero. But if C1 minus D1, this first coefficient, if that's equal to zero, that means that C1 is equal to D1. And if the second coefficient, or last coefficient, for example, CK minus DK, the only way I can solve this equation is by taking all the coefficients equal to zero. Well, then I'll need CK minus DK to equal to zero. And that's simply going to imply that CK is equal to DK. So in fact, if the vectors were linearly independent, there would be only one way of writing a given vector. You can write it two different ways, but as soon as you apply linear independence, you're able to conclude that in fact all the coefficients have to match anyway. Okay, so what that tells us then is to get a basis, just get a good set of coordinates for vectors in a subspace, we need a set of linearly independent vectors to generate W. So let me put it another way. A given list of vectors is going to be a basis for a subspace if and only if, first of all, you have to be able to reach every point in your subspace by taking linear combinations of your given set. And second of all, you want to be able to reach a given point inside this subspace by only one particular linear combination. But I'm going to replace that uniqueness property, the uniqueness of an expansion of a vector inside W with respect to that basis, I'm going to replace it by the linear independence condition. So a set of vectors is going to be a basis for W if you have enough vectors to reach every point in W. And second of all, you want the vectors to be linearly independent. So that the only way they can satisfy an equation like this is by taking what in effect is a trivial solution where all the coefficients are equal to zero. So this means, well, both directions have to be true. All right, so some nomenclature, yeah.
So if a regular hyperplane plane not be linearly independent, if the P zero vector is not zero?
Okay, so yeah, so it's a good question because you give me an opportunity to point out that you're confusing terminology. We don't talk about hyperplanes as being linear independent. We talk about a set of vectors that make the hyperplane as being linearly independent or not. So we're concentrating on the generators. And in fact, it's not going to be a hyperplane in general. what we it's going to be a hyperplane that passes through the origin in order to be a subspace. So in today's lecture, we're restricting attention to hyperplanes that pass through the origin, the so-called spans of a set of vectors. They're always subspaces. And our problem was to find good coordinates for them. And our solution thus far, sorry, this should have been, I guess, I changed the wrong letter here. This should be a linear combination of vectors V1 through VK. And the language we'll use is that anytime you have an equation, sorry, let me write the correct equation up there. C1 plus CK VK is equal to zero vector. Anytime you have an equation like this, well, you're always going to have one simple solution where you take all the coefficients C1 through CK is equal to zero. So that solution we'll call the trivial solution of one. You get it easily simply by setting all the coefficients separately equal to zero. If there are other solutions besides this trivial one, then we'll say that this equation implies a dependence relation amongst the vectors V1 through VK. The reason why it's called a dependence relation is as follows. Let me just give you an example. Suppose we have 2x1 plus 3x2 V1 V2 plus 3 V3 is equal to the zero vector. So this would be a dependence relation if this is true and all the coefficients are not equal to zero. If the coefficients were equal to zero, then I would just have an equation that says zero is equal to zero. So this is really the only interesting case of an equation like this. And the only one that really puts restrictions on these variables or on these vectors. But what you can do then, as long as you have a non-zero coefficient, is you can use the equation itself to, let's see, minus 3v2 minus 3v3, you can use the equation to express one vector in terms of the other. And that's the dependence we're talking about when we say we have a dependence relation. If we have a solution of an equation like this, where the coefficients are not all equal to zero, it means, well, we're really going to have an equation other than zero is equal to zero, and we can use that equation to solve for one of the vectors in terms of the other. So in this presentation, V1 depends on the vectors V2 and V3. So we'll often talk not only about vectors being linearly independent, that means I cannot solve this equation unless I take all the coefficients equal to zero. I can only solve this equation by making it trivial. Zero is equal to zero. But if I have solutions other than the trivial solution, then my vectors are linearly dependent because I can use the equation to solve for one vector in terms of the other. If this is the only solution, then the equation is trivial. And there's no relationship amongst the vectors V1 through VK. And so we say they're linearly independent. So that's where that language dependence and independence is coming from. If there is an equation, then it's not the trivial equation where we set all the coefficients equal to zero. Then we could use the equation to express one of the vectors in terms of the others. And so the vectors would be dependent upon one another. But if the only way I can solve this equation is by separately setting the coefficients equal to zero, then effectively I don't have any relationship between the vectors V1 through VK, and they're independent. All right, so this is sometimes confusing logically because dependence and independence are sort of negations of one another. And sometimes we tend to focus on the case when the vectors are independent, which oftentimes you have to understand that as not dependence. Okay, so let's see. So we'll say that if the only solution, if there are non-trivial solutions of this, solutions other than the trivial solution, then we say that the vectors are linearly dependent. Okay, so that changes our problem, finding good coordinates for vectors in a subspace. So originally I phrased as the problem of finding a basis. Basis would guarantee that every vector has a unique expansion. The problem was, I don't want to check every vector in my space. And what I found is that I can get a basis as long as I'm working with sets of vectors that are linearly independent. So let me give you one simple example where a set of vectors is obviously linearly independent. I'll show you what to look for here. I did it in prose on the slides. Let me try to explain more visually on the blackboard. What I'm going to suppose here is that I have a set of vectors and for which each of these vectors has one component that can't be canceled out by the others. So let me give you an example. Suppose I had v1 equals 1, 0, 0, 1, 2, and I had a second vector v2 equals 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, the same size, 5, yeah, and maybe v3 equals 0, 0, 1, 0, 0. Okay, so here are three vectors. I claim that I can just look at these vectors and know that they're linearly independent. Why? Because suppose I multiply these things by constants, and then I add them up. C1, D1, plus C2, D2, plus C3, D3. Well, I'll get C1 times here, but I won't get any contribution. C2 times V2 is, put these C1, C2, C3 on both sides. There's not going to be any contribution in that component, nor in the third component. So I'll get C1 there, and then here, C1 times 0 is 0, and then I'll get C2 there, but there'll be no contribution from the third vector. Then I'll have C3, and then these last terms will be C1 plus C2, and then 2C1 plus C2. All right, so here's three vectors. Here's a general linear combination. The question is, how can I make such a general linear combination equal to 0? Well, to get this first component to vanish, I need to take C1 is equal to 0, because the 0 vector has all components equal to 0. And I also would need C2 is equal to 0, and I need C3 is equal to 0. And so, in fact, the only way a linear combination of these three five-dimensional vectors can produce the 0 vector is by separately taking the numbers C1, C2, and C3, all equal to 0. That's the only linear combination of these three vectors that will produce the 0 vector. Now, how did I spot it so quickly? Well, because there's no way I can get rid of the contribution from the first coordinate by adding in multiples of the second and third vector. So this guy can't be canceled by any combination of the vectors V2 and V3. So I would have to take C1 is equal to 0. So if C1 is equal to 0, then this vector doesn't appear in the sum. Then I look at this guy. Well, in order for C2 plus times V2, C3 times V3, in order for that to equal the 0 vector, I'll need, there's nothing in the third vector that can cancel the contribution in the second component coming from the second vector. So I have to take C2 is equal to 0. And similarly for C3. So the statement I'm trying to state here is that if you have a list of vectors and they have the property that for any given component, only one vector has a non-zero spot there. You won't be able to add the vectors up to produce a zero vector without taking all the coefficients equal to zero. This entry here can only be canceled by taking C1 is equal to zero, because the contribution to C2B2 and C3B3, it's not going to contribute to this first component. So I would have to take C1 is equal to zero. And similarly, in order to get a second component equal to zero in this total sum, well, there's nothing I can use in the first vector or the third vector that could cancel out the contribution from this guy. So I would have to take C2 is equal to zero. Okay, so we have a sort of a visual check as to whether or not vectors can be linearly independent. And in fact, the hint is what's coming. Notice if I take these vectors and I think of them as the rows of a matrix, I've got this matrix in row echelon form. And what happens in row echelon form is any pivot in a column, it's going to have nothing but zeros below it. And so you won't be able to do any cancellation. In fact, what I'll show you maybe in the next 5 minutes is that if you have a matrix that's in row echelon form, that its non-zero rows are automatically linearly independent, because they'll have this this problematic cancellation. Is that below the pivot, I won't be able to use linear combinations of the rows below a pivot in order to get rid of the contribution of the pivot to the total sum. Okay, but let's see. Here's the visual demonstration of what I was talking about before. If you have a set of two vectors, then they're not going to be linearly independent. The way I can spot that is that this component cannot be canceled with that component, and this component cannot be canceled with that component. So, in fact, the only way I can get a linear combination of these two particular vectors equal to zero is to separately take the coefficient x1 of the first vector and the coefficient x2 of the second vector. They separately have to vanish. All right, and so applying that observation to the rows of a matrix, well, if you take a linear combination of the row vectors of a matrix and the matrix is in row echelon form, that's going to mean that there's going to be the first row has a pivot furthest to the left, and the rows below it don't have any entries below that first pivot. And so I won't be able to have these vectors sum to zero without taking x1 is equal to zero, because it has an entry that's way off to the left. It can't be canceled by the lower rows. So that would tell me that x1 would have to equal to zero. But if x1 is equal to zero, then this term vanishes. Then you look at the matrix from row 2 onward down to the kth row. And then if it's in row echelon form, there's no below the pivot in the second row, you would only have zeros. So there would be no way to cancel the contribution from the pivot in the second row with the remaining terms in this expansion, because the other vectors are not going to have components in that second slot. And so you'd have to take x2 is equal to zero. And so, so the argument then goes that you first show that the pivot, because there's nothing below the pivot in the first row, in order to get a zero vector by taking a linear combination of the row vectors, you'd have to take the first coefficient equal to zero. But then you just have a smaller matrix that's still in row echelon form, and the pivot coming from here cannot be canceled with terms from the rest of the expansion. So you get x2 is equal to zero. And you keep doing that until you finally conclude that you have to take all the coefficients separately equal to zero if the rows of a matrix, a linear combination of the rows of a matrix that's in row echelon form, if that's to produce a zero vector, all the coefficients have to equal zero. And so the non-zero row vectors of a matrix in row echelon form are always linearly independent. Okay, well, so that gives us a check. We have a list of vectors. We can write them as the rows of a matrix. And if that matrix happens to be in row echelon form, then we'll know that our vectors are linearly independent. However, here's the conclusion that I wanted to draw from the discussion on the previous slide. If you start off with a matrix in row echelon form, then its non-zero row vectors are always going to be a basis for the space that you generate by taking all possible linear combinations of the row vectors. However, I stipulate also that I only consider the non-zero row vectors. Let me give you a sort of a pedantic point, but suppose I have a matrix 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. All right, so there's a matrix with three rows, and you can ask if it's possible to solve this equation, C1 times 1, 1, 1, 0, plus C2 times 0, 0, 1, 0, plus C3 times 0, 0, 0, 0. All right, now, the three rows of this matrix are not linearly independent. Why? Because I could set this equal to 0, I could set that equal to 0, I could set that equal to 1, but 1 times the 0 vector is still the 0 vector. So I can find a choice of constant C1, C2, and C3 so that these vectors sum to the 0 vector without taking all the coefficients equal to 0. But if I threw out that 0 row, then these two vectors would be linearly independent because I can't cancel the contribution from this guy with something in the second vector. And so I'd have to take the first coefficient equal to 0, and then some multiple of this would have to equal 0, but that would force me to take the 0 multiple in order to get rid of the contribution in the third component. Okay, so matrices in row echelon form always provide a basis for the row space of the matrix, but what if you have a matrix that's not in row echelon form? What can you say then? Well, here's something we won't prove, but it's true. The row space of a matrix doesn't change when you do an elementary row operation. Oops, and I guess I'm about out of time, but let me just see if I can clarify this point, and then we'll pick up with this point on Wednesday. If you have a matrix A, whatever row is, row 1, row 2, and row 3, think of these as row vectors. When I do a elementary row operation, what happens to these is this might go to, say, lambda times row 1, and the second row might go to row 2 plus some other multiple of row 3. And maybe the third row goes to row 3 minus row 1. Suppose I do some elementary row operations on this matrix. The statement here is that although the matrix is changing under the row operations, I'll call this R of A. The span of these three rows, the set of all possible linear combinations of these three rows, is going to be the same set as the span of all possible linear combinations of these three rows. So even though we're changing the matrix, the space that's generated by the row vectors is not changing. In fact, you can understand that because if you remember where the elementary row operations came from. They came from demanding that the equations would not, their solution would not change. And in fact, manipulate equations, we're just manipulating rows of the matrix. The solution's not changing. In fact, the equivalent statement is that the space that's generated by these row vectors is not changing either. Okay, so I'll pick up with this idea on Wednesday.